Now we come to Lecture 3, Dornach, 4th of January, 1924. The way modern science looks at the situation, it concerns itself with the 70 to 80 substances which are upon the Earth, with certain forces which dominate, which exist in these substances, or determine, dominate these substances, the attractive and repelling forces and so forth. So further, forces which work through certain equivalent numbers, atom weights, and so on. Then you arrive at natural laws, and then they build up a certain fantasy structure in which man is supposed to be constructed out of the different forces whose origin one has to seek in these substances. But the situation is not like that. Man stands neither in his whole configuration nor in the forces which maintain his nutrition and growth processes. He does not at all stand merely under the influences which proceed from earthly substances. We've already seen in our considerations in reference to the ether body that these are under the influence of forces which stream in from out of the cosmos, from out of the periphery. And when you take into consideration these two kinds of forces, the forces which proceed from the substances of the earth and the forces which proceed from the periphery, you have for every organ an Ausgleich, and a equalization, a Gleichgewicht, a harmonization of these two kinds of forces is necessary in each organ. Now, in the way in which this Gleichgewicht, this equalization, this harmonization is established, in this way, the different single or human organ systems differ from each other in a very definite way. And now, from this point of view, let us consider the human head. I've already referred to the fact that the weight of the human brain to a large extent is eliminated insofar as the sharply contoured brain swims in the brain fluid. One can say in this brain fluid, which actually circulates down under through the spinal cord canal, in this brain water, the brain fluid swims. If you weigh the brain, it's about 1300 to 1500 grams. But when it's in the human being, the highest it weighs is 20 grams. And this is a result of Archimedes' law, which states that every body loses as much in its weight as it is as the displaced water, as the fluid which it displaces. The brain experiences, when it's immersed in the brain fluid, an Auftrieb, upward force, so that its actual weight remains to become 20 to 25 grams. And this, with this weight, the brain presses downwards. If it pressed downwards with its complete weight, then underneath the brain there could not be present the blood ardor system. The brain's system would be zerquetscht, squashed. One can say that from the brain is taken away the earthly property of gravity. We live with our brain not through the earth quality of gravity, but through that which wants to distance itself from the earth through the upward force which is placed against the earthly gravity. And so the brain is subject to earth gravity at the most to 20 grams. And thus, in reference to the head, we are only drawn down to the earth by a very small force. And this is one fact. And from out of this you can see that the Erdenhaftiger, the earthiness of the brain in a high grade, is disappeared through the human organization. The human organization is so arranged that the earth forces are caused to disappear. Now, this situation which occurs in the head, that the whole inner formation of the human head loses its gravity, is also present through the special Einrichtung, the special way in which the insertion of the organization, the arrangement of the human breathing process, through certain static relationships which occur between the breathing in and the breathing out. Here we have something else the case. It is the case that the breathing stoss, which is exercised through the fact that one breathes in, that this in a certain way bricht, in a certain way breaks insofar as one breathes in, and that the counterstoss, which follows in the breathing out, relates itself in a similar way. These both relate themselves to each other in a similar way as gravity and Auftrieb, uppush, gravity and buoyancy. Rothstein evidently is saying that when you breathe in and breathe out, they relate themselves in the same way as gravity and buoyancy. I assume the breathing in may be the downward is gravity, and when you breathe out, its buoyancy is an upward lift. Maybe that's the analogy. Rothstein continues, so the curious thing is that when we walk, in truth, actually, in relationship to the static relationship of our head, we let the brain in rest. The brain rests when we walk. Just as we are not made heavy because of the buoyancy of its fluid, so it is in relationship to its inner relationship when we walk. And this applies not only for our walking, but in a curious way also for the movement which we participate, mitmach, with the Erde, with the air, earth. That the movement which we mitmach with the earth, which we experience in conjunction with the earth. The movement which we make in common with the earth, we make it with pure only with the rest of our body, but not with the brain. For the brain, as far as the brain is concerned, it is continuously aufgehoben, eliminated. So that as far as the brain is concerned, which has a weight of 1500 grams, all you have left is 20 grams. Besides that, the situation is that when we, with our head, move just as fast with the rest of our body, actually, in truth, it remains in rest. Maybe it's very difficult for you to understand that which, when you look at it, seems to be in motion, yet in reality, it's resting. Maybe it's just difficult for you to imagine that, as it is for you to imagine that something which is subject to gravity actually is not heavy. But nevertheless, it is so. For the inner organization of the human being, the head is such as if it is a continuous state of rest. All the forces equalize themselves out, only that towards downwards, a lesser gravity, which lesser heaviness, which is relates itself as 20 relates to 1500, and that towards the forward direction, there exists a quite small power of forward movement. But the essentialness of the movement is equalized. So you can actually say the human head relates itself in reference to its inner experience, it relates itself to the rest of the organism in such a way as a man who sits at rest in an auto and does not move itself, does not move. Man does not move, but the auto moves, and so he goes forward. The human head experiences as if it would experience if it were not heavy. It eliminates its movement, its motion, when the man moves, and even when the man moves with the earth. Thus, the human organ of the head has something quite special insofar as it exiles itself. It excludes itself from all that which occurs upon the earth. It is only to a small extent that the earth takes part on that which is connected with the head activity. On the other hand, this whole human head is a Nachbildung, a Nachbildung of the cosmos. A copy, an after image, a reproduction of the cosmos, and has in its being nothing to do with the forces of the earth. Thus the inner construction, formation of the brain is a copy of the forces of the cosmos, and we have an inner configuration of the brain whose form we are not able to explain out of anything earthly, but we must be able to explain it out of the cosmos. The earth works only insofar as, and I have to express it very coarsely, but you'll be able to understand me, the earth works only insofar as it can break through from below, it can break through from below into the cosmic formation. It breaks the cosmic formation and inserts into the human being everything which tends towards only of which comes from the earth. You can easily see that when you perceive a skeleton. You can lift off the skull. Then you've taken away from it that which is a cosmic copy. And what you have left below that is something which is only half cosmic. Something in the half cosmic which is in the configuration of the ribs. Because that is already standing under the influence of the earthly. When finally you consider in the skeleton, you consider the tubular bones of the legs, the tubular bones of the arms, there you have something which is a purely of earthy formation. If you consider on the skeleton the dorsal vertebrae, the Rauen Rückgrat Wirbel, on which the ribs sit, There you must regard them as something that has arisen out of the equilibrium stage between the cosmic and the earthly. And if you look at the head, there you have, even in the form of the skull, something in the possibility where the cosmos tears away from the earthly, the possibility of the earthly giving it a form, and the cosmos gives it a form imitating the cosmos. That's how you have to really study the human form if you want to get anywhere. Only when you so study the human form, and besides that, know that actually the head, from the point of view of its inner experience, precisely with relationship to its soft formations, its liquid formations, is in rest. And so, as it is in rest, it is able to be a copy, it is a copy of the cosmos come to rest. Then you'll be able to see, be able to say to yourself that actually all that you find described in anatomy and physiology, that is really doesn't approximate the truth, because they don't have the consciousness as to what we are dealing with. They don't understand that which stands under cosmic influence. I've said that they are the forces which proceed out of the periphery, perceive inwards out of the periphery inwards. It is as if from all sides coming in, they enter in on from all sides onto the human head. And it's a great difference if these forces come in, and if the moon holds them back, or if the sun holds them back, or if Saturn holds them back. Through the fact that certain stars are there, you have a modification of the peripheral forces. And so it's not the same, it varies according to where the direction from where these forces come. The effect is essentially modified by the place in which any particular star stands. Now here's a thought which today in a very dilettantish way is considered, but in a very ancient times was the basis of the intuitive wisdom of the ancient astronomy. Today, out of the facts which are there, you don't get any idea really of how things stand in reality. What I have just said, it's necessary for you to understand in order to see how the human form is really constructed. Since in that which is underlies the man as far as the head is concerned, man is subject to the cosmos, and that as far as the tubular bones of the legs only subjected to the earthly, there you have expressed in a substantial manner that which really originates from the formative forces. When you have a human bone formation, you know very well that in there you have that which appears as calcium carbonate. You also have there calcium phosphate, and both have a very strong significance for the building of the bones. Through the calcium carbonate, the bones receive the property of being able to be subject to the earth. If the bone substance were not in the main permeated by calcium carbonate, then the earth could not enter into the bones. The calcium carbonate forms for the earth the substantial point of attachment, enabling it to form the bones according to their formative forces. But the calcium phosphate, they represent for the cosmos the point of attachment, the Angriff's point, in order to form the bones. When you thus, for example, have such a tubular bone as in the human Oberschenkelknochen, the human upper thigh, then this upper thigh would not be able to have its Ausdehnung, its expansion from above towards the below, if this was not mediated for it by the calcium carbonate. It wouldn't have the Schenkel Hals, the neck of the femur, if this wasn't mediated through the calcium phosphate. As far as that is concerned, that is not altered by the fact of which the sort of the objection of the anatomists that the quantity of calcium phosphate and calcium carbonate for a tubular bone and that of a the neck of a femur, neck of the femur, is not really very much different. They do not distinguish, they're not different. But in the first place, for a very much more refined investigation, that statement is not correct. They do differentiate from, they are different. But in the case of these things, there's something else which comes into consideration. The whole human organism is arranged in such a way as to have building up processes and building down processes. Processes out of which something builds itself up, and processes through which that which is not that which has been built up has not been utilized, that is abscheidet, that is excreted. A very significant difference between such building up processes and building down processes in the substances themselves can, for example, be established in the case of fluorine. The usual anatomist would say fluorine plays a role in the building up of the teeth. It can also be found in the urine. Thus, you have fluorine there and here. But that's not the situation. That's not the Rumhandelsnicht. That's not the significant aspect. In the case of the building up of the teeth, fluorine plays a positive role. The teeth could not be built up without fluorine. In the urine, you find that which you find in the urine the fluorine established in it which ought to be built down. In other words, that in the human body which is decomposition nature, building down, is found in the urine. The essential thing is that you make the distinction. If something is excreted at a certain place, and hence it's formed in that place because it's a product of excretion, or if this something is absolutely necessary in the building up process. And such, that's the position, and that's the situation. Zoistis. Do you have a portion of the bone which in essentially is built, is hereingebildet, built in from out of the cosmos? So there, the calcium phosphate is the aufbau on the building up process. But in another part of the bone, you can find calcium phosphate as an abscheidung, as an excretion, a separation, and in reverse process. In the case of the tube of a bone, the Röhrenknochen, the tubular bone, the calcium carbonate is building up and is found as a separation, as an excretion. It's separated towards that portion there, towards which there where it is out of the cosmos built in. You must say, you get nowhere by saying a certain substance is here or there. The important point is to realize or to understand what sort of path this substance has undergone, what sort of significance it has at any given place in the organism. I once attempted to explain these things to our friends in a pictorial way, insofar as I said, let us take, for example, I go at 9 o'clock in the morning, go for a walk, and I meet
at a bench, two people who are very happily together in a very friendly way are sitting down. And in the afternoon at about 3 o'clock, I return there. And again, I find the people sitting down very happy. Now, if I establish these two facts, what have I done? I've done nothing, because what can happen is it's quite possible that one person brought with him a sandwich, and so he remained there from 9 o'clock to 3 o'clock, where the other person had went away, and then he returned at 3 o'clock. One person is quite rested. The other perhaps may be frightfully tired. So the inner constitution distinguishes itself quite distinctly in both cases. The situation is not insignificant if a person is here or there, but the whole significance is, what has the person done? What has his path been in order to arrive at a certain place? In a situation, it's equivalent for a understanding of a person if an organ is composed of this or that substance. You must know how it exists in that organ, if it is a building up process or if it's in there as a result of an excretion substance. And only then can you understand the human being. You'll never be able to understand the transition from the quality of a substance which is necessary for the human organism in order to enable it to be a medicament if you do not really take this whole process in view. Only when you can do this can you actually realize that the general distribution of substances is quite different from that which is usually believed to be.
Ordinarily believes. It is a very striking fact that since 5 or 6 centuries, it is no longer being contemplated that man, that one with certain analytical processes in the human organism, as one means, can prove iron. Good heavens. What he's saying is that for 500 years, it was possible to prove that in the human organism, you can prove the presence of iron. All these processes are so that you can say, in the human organism, in the blood, there is iron. However, one will in vain attempt to investigate, to prove the existence of lead in the human being when the organism is normal. As far as lead is concerned, all we know that lead is present in lead ore in a very coarse way, grobe-klotzic way. But all the metals who are now found in our earth substance, grobe-klotzic. Grobe means in large amounts, and klotzic means clod. Well, you can understand the meaning of that. But all metals who are found grobe-klotzic in our earth substance, once upon a time in their primal gebilden, in their primal form, were once in Saturn, Sun, and so on, in a quite fluchtigen, a quite flighty, even warm etheric conditions, present as in dissolved, fluchtiger, warm etheric conditions. Now, to be sure, the human being was naturally in another form, already present as a being in ancient Saturn. He has participated in all these processes under which, for example, iron has changed from a quite fluchtigen, fine divided, warm etheric condition to that which it is today. Man has participated in the development of the world. The special situation is that man, in reference to iron, in reference to magnesium, so arranged himself that he has taken up these substances into his own formation. However, the lead he has overcome. Thus, in reference to the magnesium, he related himself in such a way that he had united the magnesium process with his own process. In reference to the lead, he related himself that he fled away from the lead process, that he expelled it. So in relation to magnesium, we see how in the human being the same forces dominate, Vulton, which occur outside in magnesium. Man must inwardly overcome them. However, before the human being was enclosed by his skin, as at the time when he was still had a metamorphosing construction, which was united with the cosmos, then he overcame the lead process. So today, he still has in himself the overcoming, the expelling of the lead processes. He has in himself the building up forces of the magnesium. He has in himself the expelling forces for the lead process. Now, what does all this mean? All you have to do is to study what happens to the human organism when it has a lead poisoning. It becomes brookig in this, crumbly, sclerotish. Hence, you're able to say the human organism cannot tolerate lead in itself. If a lead poisoning occurs, so there is in the human organism lead. The organism, to be sure, begins to battle the process which is in the lead substances. Substances are always processes. The lead spreads itself out in the organic process. The organism outfruited itself, builds itself up, begins to battle in order to seek to drive out the lead. And when he's able to do that, he becomes healthy. If the lead is stronger, he doesn't become healthy. There occurs the well-known cephal process, decomposition process, which occurs in the lead poisoning of the human organism. Because the human organism can only tolerate the lead overcoming processes, the processes which overcome the lead. He can't tolerate in himself the lead substance building forces, the forces coming from the lead substance. Now when you investigate what the human being has from the fact that he can't tolerate lead in himself, you arrive at the following. You must realize that the human being is, in the first place, a sense being. He perceives object around him, and then he nachdenkt. He thinks about these things. He needs both processes. He must perceive things in order that he can come into connection with the world. He must also nachdenk, think after them. He must zurückdrängen, means to suppress back his perception, and in the process of suppressing back, he then develops a selbstständigkeit, an independence. If we all the time would only just perceive, then we would dissolve ourselves always in the external Anschauen, in the external perception. But on the contrary, through the fact that we retreat, zurücktreten from the things, we retreat from the things, and then think about them, only through that fact do we become a personality, an individuality. And through that, we do not dissolve away into the objects. And when one studies the human ether body, so it has in itself a center for lead-repelling forces. The center is approximately there where the hair forms its virbal, its vortex, its eddy, its whirlpool, its crown of the head. I don't know how to translate the virbal here. The place where the hair forms its virbal. Does he mean the crown of the head where the hair forms? I don't know. I can't translate that. You have to work it out yourself, find out yourself. I can't do it. From that point, there stream out the lead overcoming forces. They radiate into the whole, everywhere over into the whole organism, in order that indeed the lead forming forces should not be allowed to enter into the organism. These lead overcoming forces, which the body has constructed, has developed, have a great significance through the fact that these very same lead overcoming forces make the following situation, that when I look upon this piece of chalk, I do not remain captured in a simple gazing upon the chalk. Otherwise, I myself would identify myself with that which I am gazing upon. I make myself independent. I weaken, ablema, I weaken the observation. But I do it with the same forces which are the lead overcoming forces, so that the human being can thank these lead overcoming forces for the fact that he can become an inwardly geschlossener, self-contained, enclosed personality. The fact that the human being can separate himself from the world, that he can thank the lead overcoming forces. It is shown so that these forces which sit in the human being and whose existence can really first become very striking to the individual when one considers a certain connection which I shall soon mention to you. Not only a physical etheric significance, but actually durchaus thoroughly also they have a psychic moral significance. I would say a soul moral significance. What I want to say is the following. Man takes into himself certain metal bodies which he unites with his own corporeal organism. Other metal bodies he overcomes, überwindet. He has them in themselves only as a repelling process, as an overcoming process in himself. Now the question is, how has it arisen that the human being, in the course of his long development from the Saturn period to the Sun period and so forth, and so far, and so further, that certain substances which have arisen in the outside, he has ausgeschieden, he has repelled, and others he has taken up, taken into himself. In this ausscheiden, in this separating out, there lies at the same time that which enables the human being to take into himself selbstständige moral forces, self-contained, independent moral forces. The situation is that if the human being would, for example, be predisposed to have in himself lead forming forces, you can imagine that the present organism now indeed does not, cannot need lead, but that it that he has some sort of lead forming forces in him, that he has in himself lead in the same sense as he now has in himself iron, then the man, as far as the lead with them, then man, with lead it is so, the man would have in himself half moral qualities. He would carry these half moral qualities into himself from the lead. And then man would become somewhat krankhaft, ill nature. We would call it an illness to have an affinity for that which is of an external Unreinigkeit in the Welt, an external impurity in the world. Mankind would have an urge to want to seek up stinking, smelling substances and to smell them in order to dissolve himself into them. And when you have a child, and sometimes you can observe in the child that the child himself has such perverse qualities. And there are children like that who preferentially seek all stinking materials. Enjoy with their nose, for example, petroleum. And that is caused by the fact that always they do not have present these lead-repelling forces of the blood. And then you have to attempt, through a clinical or even through a medical working in of medicaments, to call up these lead-repelling force. Later speak about how the way of doing this. Now let's consider the case of magnesium, which plays a certain definite role in the human organism. Often in our pedagogical talks, I told you that we must sharply cut off the first life period, that which goes to the change of teeth. Then the next cut-off is puberty. Now the situation is that fluorine is necessary for the building of teeth, but also magnesium is necessary for the building of teeth. But teeth formation doesn't exist only in the mouth, in the upper jaw and the lower jaw, but the whole organism participates in this. The magnesium process plays itself, occurs in the whole human organism, and that signifies for the human being the most important factor, a most important factor, until the change in the teeth. After that point, after the change of the teeth, the magnesium has no longer that great significance which it formerly had. Since the magnesium forces in the human being, they harden, they härten, make hard, harden his organism. They draw the organism into itself. And I might say the culminating point, the end point of this consolidation of the human organism, this in sich gliedern, the in sich membering of the forces and substances, that finds its end point in the change of teeth with the receiving of the second teeth. Until that point, the application of the use of magnesium has the Verwendung from magnesium. Now what it means, the use, Verwendung. Use of magnesium, the application of magnesium has the most greatest significance for the human organism. Now the human organism in relationship to its time development is a complete whole. It must develop magnesium in itself. It must have it in itself. It wouldn't have the correct forces of consolidation if it didn't have these magnesium processes in itself. And so he cannot stop producing these magnesium forces. This occurs after the change of teeth, just as it does before the change of the teeth. These must be worked over in the organism. And so after the change of teeth, the most important thing is, the essential thing is, that the magnesium is overcome, that it is expelled. It draws itself specially into the human milk secretion. It is specially excreted with the milk. Now, insofar as the milk secretion is connected with the puberty, you see a very remarkable connecting process, a periodic process. Take the magnesium. It is, until the change of teeth, it is, so to say, consumed by the human organism. After, from the change of teeth to puberty, it is excreted. And among the forces which form the milk forces, there is magnesium as an upsiding, a secretion. After there comes a Rückschlag until the 20th year. Rückschlag, that's a rebound, a recoil, a backfire, a reaction, a setback. In this case, it means that after that period, there's a reversal of the process, I think. The Rückschlag means a reversal until the 20th year. Then the magnesium forces find an application, Verwendung, for the finer consolidation of the muscles. Substances are actually only a putting together, a Zusammensetzung of processes. Lead is only apparently this grobe, grey-looking substance. It is an onsinn, it is nonsense to say that it is a piece of grobe substance. Lead is that process which proceeds within the borders which are drawn together by the Ausbreitung of the lead. Everything is process. We can say that the substantial processes are not only so in the human being, that certain substantial processes can be worked over in the human being, and certain other processes can be able to be repelled, as in the lead process, which we never are able to use, in which we always must have the expelling force. But there are others, such as the magnesium process, which so is that it rhythmically interchanges, that we actually develop in the rhythmical periods of life the consuming processes for the magnesium forces, and then the separating process, the abscheidende, the separating processes. From all this you can really see that you have nothing really when you merely analyze something and say human organism has magnesium. And there is nothing said when you say that in the 12th year these substances have a quite other significance than in the fifth or the fourth year. Only then do you learn to know the human being, when you know that certain substantial processes, which is to say substances, have this or that significance in the human organism. If you want to know how substances which exist out there in the world of nature, how they're able to work on further in the human organism, then it is the most of very insignificant to study the chemical composition of the substances. One must be able to study something which is scarcely studied. If you follow the way substances were studied until the 13th or 14th century, there you have the first beginnings to a the Anlagen, the real predispositions to the present chemistry. These are Anlagen were present in which were present in the at that time, and which appeared in those alchemical processes appear to us often to be silly and ridiculous. Forget something else is involved here. At that time there was present something which didn't have a continuation. That which today you can call the teaching of signature. The signature teaching, which was applied especially for plants, but also for minerals. This signature teaching never had its continuation, was not developed further. Now just consider a substance like antimony, this gray antimony ore. The peculiarity of antimony is that it receives the well-known spießiger Gestalt, the javelin Gestalt, this haarförmig Gestaltung, hair-forming Gestaltung, bristle configuration. I don't know that. Now, when you handle antimony in a certain way, then you receive the antimony mirror. When, for example, you deposit the evaporated antimony on a cold surface, you have everywhere in the gray ore antimony the tendency to construct forms which actually very significantly show as forms of the ether body. It appears to be very similar to that which forms in the forms of certain simple plants which adapt themselves, conform themselves to the ether body. When you contemplate antimony substance, you have directly the feeling that this antimony is very receptive for ether forces. The ether forces schmiegt hinein, adapts themselves into it. Everybody can confirm this by the fact that when you handle antimony electrolytically and under certain circumstances bring it to the cathode, then there arise a series of explosions, and these überleiten, they form a transition into the connection of antimony to the ether forces. This is a very striking case, but for these sort of things, one once upon a time had a very strong ability to grasp. But today, this ability is no longer there. One doesn't respect such considerations as those which I've just presented. For that reason, we've arrived at things, the situation in which we confront significant perceptions, and we seem to be rutless. We don't know what they are. Thus, for example, you have diamond, graphite, anthracite, coal. All that is coal, but very different. And why is that so? However, if the human being, all that is carbon, and why is that so? If the human being would really be able to go investigate not just the purely chemical properties, but that which in the old sense was called the signature, so you would begin to understand the difference between coal and graphite. Coal arose during the earth process. Graphite arose during the moon process, which preceded the earth, and diamond arose during the sun process. And so when you look at the things this way, you can get an idea how it doesn't, it's not the substance that's the important thing, but what is important is under what circumstances and times a certain substance acquired a solid form. And so we see that time can have a definite significance. And you look at it this way, you can say, coal is a child, not very old. Graphite is a young man, older. Diamond, if it's not really an old man, it's still very strongly a man. Here we can see the necessity to investigate the cosmic processes if you want to learn the connections of that which is outside. If antimony has a strong sensation, perception for the human sensibility, for the human ether body, and you bring antimony as a medicament into the human organism, so you must recognize what connection it has also outside the human being when you want to recognize what is stimulated through antimony in the human ether body. You must go into the finer processes of nature if you want to understand what any sort of medicament it will perform in the human being. And here's the end of the lecture.